some of the stars through the airwaves and on the big screen. Coming to you live from Hollywood, it's Rated G Radio with your host, Garrett Miller.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Rated G Radio. This is our first show of the week, and this is kind of an oddball week as far as shows goes, because I've had a bunch of things that have come up, all great, but it's kind of impacted how we're doing things this week. So just as a quick heads up, I always let you know that, you know, where we're going and where we've been. Les Charnas is our guest tonight. He's going to be on in just a couple of moments talking about his I'll let him classify it, but it's a fun read called South. And if you haven't heard of it yet, you're going to hear about it tonight. And I've got a link to his Amazon page and his website and all the good stuff on the show. You'll definitely want to be heading over there after the show to buy the books. If you have to have them tonight, get them on Kindle. And then, of course, you know, get your 10 copies, one for you and then nine for your friends you can give out as gifts later in the year. But Lance will be on in just a moment. Rebecca Fisk was going to be our guest tomorrow morning, and she has graciously allowed us to reschedule her for June because I was able to book a voiceover gig tomorrow with Bruce Hart. Bruce has been on the show before. He has been, he is an actor. He's appeared in several TV projects and independent films. He's got a new movie called Open that's coming out, and he needed some extra help tomorrow. So I said, Rebecca, I've got to be there at a certain time. And she says, no worries, go do that. So we'll have Rebecca on in June. So if you're expecting to tune in tomorrow morning, please, you can listen to this show again. That would not hurt my feelings, but Rebecca won't be on in the morning. She'll be back next month. On Thursday's Rated LGBT Radio, my co-host Rob Watson and I are going to be welcoming Daniela Sulek. She is an expert at the law of attraction, and she loves talking about love relationships. So if you would like to ask a question or hear more, Thursday at 7 o'clock is the place to be. On Friday's Friday Night Dance Party, our last show of the week, we're going to be doing a special start time of 6 p.m. And we're going to be doing we're going to flip flop the guest and the, you know, your requests around, because we're going to do requests in hour number one at 6 p.m. Pacific time. And then we're doing a world premiere, yet another one here on the show with Ed Roman's Red Omen. Now, I'm not really quick to the party here, folks, but if you take Ed Roman and mix up the letters, it actually spells Red Omen. So there's our little play on words. And that's going to be Friday night on the dance party. World premiere of Ed Roman. He'll be back. He was on just a few weeks ago, and I said, you know, anytime you want to come back, let me know. And he says, I've got a new album coming out. And of course, that is what we're going to be talking about on Friday's show. So tune into that Friday, the special start time of 6 p.m. Pacific time. Tonight, we're going to be joined by Lance Charnas. He, again, is the author of South. He's got a couple of other projects that are out there. He's also been, he's got a huge, I think I could have him on for about a 6-hour block and would still not even scratch the surface, but we've got him for an hour tonight. But he's got a huge career of interesting paths that he's taken, and he's written a book called Doha 12. Lance, you'll tell me if I got that wrong. Book South, which we're going to talk about tonight. He's got another project called The Collection, and he's also, and I'm looking at this now, I haven't watched any of the videos yet, but he's got a YouTube channel out there talking about crimes against art. So we want to know all about that. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to welcome Lance to the show. Thanks for taking time out of your Tuesday night. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. Thanks for having me on, Garrett.
Right on. So I always want to give mad props to everybody, you know, when they make a connection in here to the show, because, you know, the guests tend to line up, and I love it because it makes my job easier. So Maddie over at Lit Up in Orange County, thank you very much for suggesting Lance be on the show tonight. We have Maddie to thank for that. When is the next Lit Up event, Lance? Do you have that off the top of your head?
Yes, I do. The next Lit Up is actually next Tuesday. It's at 7 p.m. on the 24th of May at Keen Coffee in Tustin.
Okay, cool. Got to put that on the calendar.
Yeah, if you're interested in finding out more, there's the Lit Up OC Facebook page that has everything Lit Up on it.
Well, and, you know, I went to Lit Up for the first time last month, really just to kind of see, you know, what was going on, because Maddie's talked to me about it for a long time. And I was shocked because it was basically standing room only by the time I got there. And I got there probably right at 7 o'clock. But there were people out the door waiting to hear the authors read and do a Q&A with Maddie. And it's a great opportunity just to meet other fellow writers that are in the area. What's been your experience with the group?
Well, I've been I've been a performer at Lit Up, I think, four times now. It's been a really interesting 2 years. This month is the second birthday for Lit Up. We started out with just a few people who kind of hung around at Keene to see what was going on. And over that time, Maddie, through all of her efforts and bringing in all of the authors, has been able to build an audience that has gotten into, you know, 25, 30 people who show up pretty much all the time, plus whatever the individual authors bring in with them. So there have been times where it has been standing room only and we were dragging in chairs from outside and the whole thing. But it's been a lot of fun. We've gotten a lot of variety. We've gotten some really interesting writers in, a few, you know, New York Times bestseller type people, and some folks who have just published their first book, traditional publishers, the indie publishers, the whole thing. So it's been a really interesting and a really fun trip, and Maddie has done a fabulous job on it. And she just took it, you know, the bit in her teeth and has run with it. And has done just a great job. So we're really proud of it.
You know, the thing I find interesting about this is that, you know, on a Tuesday night at 7 o'clock, when people could be home watching the news or Jeopardy or something like that, you have such a great group of people that come together with a common purpose, their love of either writing or reading books. And
right.
I just thought that was, well, you know, I know Maddie's put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into it, but I was just kind of shocked that was, you know, the size of group that we're going to see at this type of event. So, you know, my hat's off to Maddie for all the work that she's done, and congratulations on your four appearances there.
Yeah, thank you.
So let's get now. It's all about you, Lance. So for the next hour, it's all Lance. So before we get into the book, so I always want to kind of know a little bit about you as a person and your background and all of the things that have made you who you are today, so you can get to the point where you say, you know what, I'm going to sit down and write a book. So as we get started, and this is your first time on the show, hopefully first of many, I'll always say, you know, Lance, tell us about yourself. Who are you, and how did you come to be the person you are today?
Oh, boy. Well, you were mentioning my kind of twisting career path during the intro there. And I never really planned any of that. It all just kind of happened freeform. I'm a California native, fifth generation Californian.
Wow.
My great-grandfather or somebody came across the plains in a covered wagon, ended up in Placerville, and apparently got relatively wealthy running a store for the gold miners. And he was a German immigrant, and he wrote a diary about his trip across the plains, and it ended up getting discovered by a grad student at Stanford in the 30s who translated it, and we got a copy of it. And everything that you've ever seen in a Western, you know, wagon train going across the prairie type thing, that happened to him.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's nuts. The deserts and the lack of water and the, you know, Indians and, you know, the whole nine yards. I mean, it all happened to him, and he ended up going into Placerville completely broke, and then made a fortune. You know, my roots are very deep in California, I grew up in Northern California. Mm-hmm. I was in the San Francisco Bay Area. And went to Berkeley. I got to Berkeley through an ROTC scholarship. So I went to Air Force ROTC, which meant I knew exactly what I was going to be doing for the 4 years after I got out of school. Then went to the Air Force and stayed in there on active duty for almost 8 years, then went to the reserves, then did all this other stuff that I did. And it's the long and winding road led me to where I'm at now, and had a couple of changes of career along the way. And so I do a little of this and a little of that. But I've been writing off and on since I can remember. I mean, the first thing that I remember writing was Adam 12 fan fiction. So if that...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, in like fourth grade. So... So I've been writing off and on since then. And after a while, with enough practice, you get okay at it. And so now I'm at a point where I can share what I've been writing with people who aren't related to me, which is a really cool thing.
So when did you know you had a – I mean, when did you really know that this was going to be like the gift that you wanted to share with the world?
I always enjoyed writing, and I was always pretty good at it. I've always, liked doing creative things, but I discovered that I'm not much of a musician. I have a hard time reading music, which is a handicap for a musician. I don't draw especially well. I can draft, and I can render, but I can't draw.
Okay.
Particularly well. I never had any training in it. And so, and the kind of sculpture that I did was electronic. And so I was doing 3D modeling when I was in my game artist phase. But the thing that I always came back to is that I was able to write and I enjoyed doing it. And so it was something that I always knew was around. I just, finally, later on in life, decided that I was going to do it regularly and do something with it.
And that sounds so easy here. And I'm going to tell you, Lance, I love that answer. But looking at your bio here, where you're an active member in the U.S. Air Force, you worked in the White House, you planned the Los Angeles subways, and I can go on and on. And then, all of a sudden it says I started art history and set design and became a game artist for Activision and 3DO. And I'm like, whoa, that from somebody who is, I'm not expecting a career as a writer from somebody who is really more, I say structured, and that's probably not the right word to use, but it just seems like it's such a completely different, career that you've had in the past to get to the point you say, this is what I'm going to do now.
Well, not so much. When I took computer science at Cal, but I was in the programming side of it. I wasn't in the engineering side of it. I had to take my one or two hardware courses and didn't particularly like them, but I liked programming. And so that basically made me a languages major.
Oh.
I wasn't an engineer.
And
so I was having to learn new languages and learn how to, quote unquote, talk in them in order to get results. And so that kind of worked in with the whole facility with language thing. My SATs were kind of backward from the typical guy. My verbal, scores were higher than my math scores were.
Mm-hmm.
And usually it's the other way around for a guy. And then when I got into the Air Force and I was doing IT type things, the kind of things that I ended up doing, I built a graphical decision support system for the commander to keep him up on what was going on with all the test sites. And so it was something where, the guy who couldn't find the M on the keyboard would be able to go in and, click on a map and see what was happening in, that particular test program, and which was actually pretty cutting-edge stuff for 1983.
Sure.
Which is when I'm doing it. So, again, there I was doing something that was kind of creative. And, there was a lot of, there was database programming and, stuff like that going on. But, I was also doing the front end and the user interface. And that was kind of creative, especially since there weren't any really good models around for it back then. I was kind of into kind of make it up as I went along. And then when I went to the White House, Situation Support Staff, one of the things that I kind of fell into is that I was running what was essentially a video production facility for them.
How cool
so
is
I
that?
Had this, yeah, I know. It was really cool. We had the best toys because everybody wanted to be able to say, well, our equipment is in the White House.
Right.
And
right.
So we got the greatest stuff. And so I had this little video production facility, racks and racks and racks full of equipment. And we had what was then, a bleeding edge multimedia presentation center. And that was mine.
Wow.
And, you know, I had a couple of people who worked for me, and we made sure that we were able to produce the products that we needed to get across to the national security advisors, staff, and to the cabinet minister or cabinet members, and you know, ultimately the president and the chief of staff, what was going on in this fast paper environment that, you know, so they could grasp it very quickly and intuitively. And so, again, it was making up a lot of stuff as we went along because, again, there weren't really good models for this yet. I mean, this was, you know, 1987 that we were doing that. And so that was actually very creative. I did, you know, some database programming and that kind of thing, but, you know, mostly what I was doing was running that facility and putting together briefings and putting together visual aids and things like that. So it was is very creative and it was very visual. And then when I got to the red line, that was pretty straight ahead IT. You know, that was crawling under people's desks to, you know, fix their computers and, you know, my printer won't work, come fix it and all that kind of thing. And it was somewhere in there, you know, a couple of years in, I was saying, you know, this isn't really all that interesting. So
is there more to life?
You know? Yeah, is this all there is? You know, I had Peggy Lee, you know, singing in the background there. And so I discovered that UCLA Extension had this certificate program for film, TV, and video design.
Oh, wow.
And so I was thinking, you know, that sounds pretty cool. And so I started in on that. And it was, you know, I didn't really have an end game for this. It sounded cool and the classes were interesting. And I got into 3D modeling through one of the earlier PC-based programs for that. It was called 3D Studio, which was a real pain in the butt to use, but because it was that, I've ended up having to learn how to work around the problems, and then having the programming and the IT background, I was able to understand what the program was doing so I could figure it out. And then got into digital rendering, and I started thinking, you know, this is pretty cool, and this was about the time that 3D computer graphics were getting big in film and TV.
Oh,
and so I thought, you know, this could be like a real thing. And so I was, you know, started learning, you know, drafting and, you know, rendering and architecture and color theory and, you know, the whole nine yards. And I started putting together a demo reel. I started teaching at a computer center that was run by IATSE, which is the trade union for the Hollywood crafts, and, you know, did some of this and some of that. And by 1995 or so, I was building sets for you know, student films at AFI. I worked on a commercial, worked on a couple indie films, and it was all, you know, set building, set design, you know, that kind of thing. And in 95, I said, okay, I'm done with IT. I've been doing IT for, you know, X number of years, and I'm tired of crawling under people's desks. It's time to do something else, and that's when I cut loose from there and ended up a few months later getting the job with Activision doing game art, which is something I had never thought of until
it has
just kind
happen,
of presented
you know?
Itself. Yeah, it just kind of presented itself. I mean, I'd like computer games sort of, and, you know, played some of the early ones and, you know, graphics. Oh, well, yeah, okay.
They were horrible.
All right. They were terrible, yeah. But by about that point, they were starting to get good. And the machines were around that were powerful enough to start getting really good graphics in it, and that's what made it interesting. So when I got hired on to do Interstate 76, which is a car combat game, muscle car combat game in alternative 1976 in the American Southwest,
Right on.
It was a really cool game. If you ever wanted to, you know, take your Hot Wheels cars and then put your G.I. Joe guns on top of them, that was kind of what we were doing. But you know, the graphics were just great for the time.
Yeah.
And that made it really interesting. I was doing all of the built environments for them because I'd had this, you know, architecture and design education, and I knew how buildings went together. I knew what the Southwest was supposed to look like because I lived there for 4 years at the Air Force. And so I ended up building the landscapes and the buildings for it and some of the cars. And that just kind of got me into that, and I kept, you know, doing that, and then moved off to 3DO.
Can I ask you a question about that before we move? Because I am fascinated by that, Lance. You just pay $50 or $60 or however much video games are to then, you just expect the graphics to be fantastic. But, you know, going back to 95, 96, 97, you're right. I mean, it was still kind of bad. And then that's right when everything got good. So what kind of things, as you're sitting here trying to build these sets designs, do they give you any kind of, okay, here's our list. You're going to have this and that and the other thing. And did you have, what kind of challenges did you have as a programmer to get these things to look really fantastic for that time?
Well, I mean, the programmer's challenges were, you know, huge because they were building the whole game engine. And, you know, having to render this environment at a frame rate that would allow you to play a car combat game. And
it's memory hogs.
Well, they're huge memory hogs, they're huge processor hogs, and it's not like, for instance, the racing games. And if you remember, the car racing games were the first ones that started having the really nice graphics on them.
Yep.
Because you're on a track, and you can only go in two directions. And so it only had to look good in two directions. And now, Interstate 76 was this open arena game. You could, if you didn't get yourself killed, you could go out and you could drive for long periods of time and see stuff out there. And so we had to build these really big worlds. And the polygon count was huge because, you know, every polygon is mathematical, you know, calculation, and it's a rendering job, and so the rendering engine has to be able to paint every single one of the polygons that are out there really fast. And so you have to minimize the number of polygons. So if you think, you know, you look at your typical, you know, say you're building a GTO, you know, a Pontiac GTO.
Right.
Guns on it. And, you know, you look at that and you say, oh, you know, how many pieces would I have to make that in and to make it look like a GTO? And you may think, well, you know, thousands of pieces in that. Well, no, you get, you know, your polygon budget is like 400. And so that's what the artist, that's what we had to deal with, is that we would have to build a car that you could look at close up and was made out of 400 pieces.
Wow.
Yes. And so we had to get really good at being very, very efficient at modeling and also very efficient at texturing, because much of what you're seeing is actually the texture that's laid on the 3D model. And you can't have, you know, these enormous high-res, well, you couldn't back then, enormous high-res, you know, graphics that you'd put on them, because that would fill up the frame buffer and it would blow up and it wouldn't work. And so we would have, you know, you could have like two 512 by 512 pixel textures that you can put on that car.
That's not a lot.
That's not a lot. You run out of space real fast. And so that was also the other challenge, you know, how do you skin these things so they look good when you're, you know, ramming into them, so you're, you know, staring at them right up there.
Yeah.
And be able to have like five or six others in the viewport and have the buildings and the mountains and the sky and the moving clouds and all that kind of thing, and do it in, you know, not a whole lot of space. So that was the kind of thing that we were dealing with all the time. It was a constant battle to, you know, looks versus efficiency. And we were dealing with that all the way throughout.
Did you have like team meetings and staff meetings where you're yelling at each other going, we have to have the mountains, we don't have the budget, or it takes up too much? I mean, did you
go through a lot of that? Stuff like that, and you know, often what it was, you know, the programmers were behind on, you know, building in a feature that we had asked for, and it's like, are we going to get that feature? Because, you know, if we don't, we can't do, you know, X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll get to it. Well, in the meantime, we can't build the art and test it because, you know, we don't have that thing built into the engine. And so, you know,
right,
back and forth. And I'll say, okay, so now we're behind and we're getting all uptight because, you know, now they're saying, oh, you know, Art, you're behind, you're not building all your stuff. Well, we can't until you know, blah, blah, blah. So that was the kind of thing that we would get.
Wow.
So it was a really interesting environment, as you can imagine.
What I think is interesting, at least to me, Lance, is I know creative people and I know IT people. They rarely, at least in my experience, they don't rarely share the same plate. They're usually on two opposite ends of the things. And you seem to have a very good understanding at the time, and I'm sure even today, of what each of those worlds needs to cohabitate successfully together. So I think that's really amazing in itself, because that's a lost art.
Yeah, it really helped that I had been a programmer once upon a time, and so I could talk to the programmers and understand what was going on and, you know, talk their language and then go back and talk with the artist, because, you know, then I was one. And so, you know, I had to talk in their language and, you know, explain what was going on. So that, you know, having had a foot in both camps, that really helped. So I was also older than a good many of the people that I was working with at that point. This was my midlife crisis.
I like a midlife crisis that has a fun job, though.
Yeah, that's good. And it's, you know, rather than doing the red convertible and the cheerleader thing, which my wife wouldn't have appreciated at all.
No, not so much.
No, and it doesn't go over too well. You know, I instead got into this crazy business. And the really cool thing, though, was being able to go into the store and, you know, point to that box on the shelf and say, I made that.
Oh, wow. Wow. What did you do first time? Did you, well, I suppose you got them for free because you worked at the company, but did you ever go to like Target or Kmart or wherever and say, okay, I'm going to buy this and, you know, actually have a receipt for this?
No, I didn't go to buy it, but it was kind of cool to go by there and see, you know, like the kids browsing the shelves and say, oh, wow, Interstate 76, that's supposed to be cool. And, you know, they're reading the back of the box and looking at the fake screenshots and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, you know, that's really cool. I had the same feeling when I was working on the Red Line the first time we were able to get on one of the trains and ride it. And it's like, wow, we helped build this. This is really
cool. Like you never thought the day would come, and then it's there.
No, and then it's there, and it's real. And then, you know, like people are writing on it, and, you know, they start taking it for granted that it's just always been there. And it's like, wow, somebody's actually using something that, you know, I built or that I helped build. So that's
really
cool.
This is a great time, everybody. We're at the halfway mark. I can't even believe it. We're here with author Lance. I know. Time flies by. It's Lance Charnas. He's the author of South. We're actually going to talk about his writing when we come back. We're going to take a very short commercial break from It Matters Radio and our friends at Rainbow Brew. We'll be right back after this.
Welcome to our discussion of It Matters Radio. Our guest today is Angus McWilliams.
Hey, laddie, let's get on with this thing. I'm on my way to a birthday party for Nessie.
You're throwing a birthday party for the Loch Ness Monster?
Well, first of all, it's not a monster. And second of all, I'm talking about niece Nessie. She's a wee bit of a lovely lass.
I see. Well, okay. Angus, can you give us your thoughts on It Matters Radio?
Hey, wonderful people. They had me on a while back to talk about my book.
Your what?
My book. I wrote a book about the adventures in Scotland.
Oh, I see. A book.
That's what I just said. What are you, Duff, man?
It Matters Radio focuses on discovering new talent and bringing important indie artists on the air. Monica, Kenneth, and Carrie offer up meaningful conversation on new music, books, and fun topics. It's unlike any other radio program known to man and woman alike.
You can say that again.
Known to man and woman alike.
Just because I said you can say it again doesn't mean you have to say it again.
I'm just doing my best to show everyone that It Matters Radio basically brings variety, fun, and entertainment with a sincere desire to discover new topics and talent.
Well, why didn't you just say that?
I just did.
Hey, Letty, remind me when I can listen.
It Matters Radio is on every Thursday night, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific.
You Americans with your different time zones. We only have one time zone in Scotland.
And that would be...
That would be the time to down a pint or two of ale.
It Matters Radio, for the best in conversation, music, books, and entertainment. Join us Thursday evenings at 9 Eastern, 6 Pacific. Discover the depth, diversity, meaningfulness, caring, guest-focused, friendly, enjoyable atmosphere of It Matters Radio with Ken, Monica, and Carrie.
That's a mouthful of alcohol, one.
Yes, and I'm going to go brush my teeth now. It Matters Radio.
When it comes to coffee, freshness is queen. That's why Rainbow Brew believes you should have the freshest coffee, roasted to order in small batches and delivered to your door within a couple days. Whether you're purchasing for a coffee shop, restaurant, or home, Rainbow Brew is your one-stop shop for fair trade and organic coffee. Offering many unique blends, including AM 950's own Blue State blend. That's Rainbow Brew, the Queen Bean, a proud sponsor of the Morning Grind. Online at rainbowbrew.com. Brew something good today.
Thank you, It Matters Radio and Rainbow Brew. By the way, if you do go buy some Rainbow Brew at rainbowbrew.com, tell them that you heard them here on Rated G Radio. They actually do a happy dance specifically for the show before they grind your beans and put them in the mail and send them off to you fresh. They're based out of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and if you ever think that there's no way you can have good-tasting coffee grown out of that region of the country, you're wrong, and they've got great different flavors. If you're a coffee drinker, go try them out. We are joined tonight by Lance Charnas. He's the author of South. We spent the first half hour talking about some of his career adventures before becoming a full-time writer, and I'm afraid if we don't change the topic now to his writing, we won't even get to the part where he wrote this book, South, that I've been reading today. It is... As novels go, entertaining and a page turner. And I told Lance right before the show started, I said, I'm woefully sorry I didn't get farther along in the book because I always try to get the book finished before the guest comes on. But now I will have something to read tonight as I get ready to wind up my day. And I'm excited to finish the book. But Lance, instead of me telling you about all the characters that you're like, well, I know I wrote the book. What is South about, and when did you come up with the idea for this particular type of plot and twist and story? We might have some audio difficulty. Let's try this again. Lance,
nope,
do I have
back.
You back? There we
go.
Yeah,
I'm back. Sorry.
Okay, cool. No worries.
Yeah, no worries.
Tell us about South.
South is set in 2032. And the main character, Luis Ojeda, is just a guy runs a auto shop in Costa Mesa, California, and he lives in Orange County. The country has changed, but it hasn't changed as much as you might think. So basically, as I put it in the back cover copy, government's been downsized and outsourced into irrelevance, and only the very wealthy few can afford hopes or dreams. Pretty much, you know, the bottom 90% are really poor, and the top 10% are incredibly rich. So, you know, we're back in the Gilded Age here, essentially. In 2019, there was a major terrorist attack in Chicago, and that helped bring a new president in who decided that the answer to the Muslim problem in America was detention camps. And so now in this new America, 400,000 American Muslims are in a number of detention camps throughout the western United States, and the others who are living here are trying to get out of the country. And so for several years, Luis, whose dad was a coyote, became a reverse coyote. He started leading Muslims out of the country into Mexico, and then he got shot and retired, he thought. And then just, of course, when you think you're out, they would drag you back in. He gets forced into trying to bring out this Muslim family who are trying to escape because supposedly the husband is going to be sent to a camp. And the wife, Nora, is an FBI agent. And so he's not very happy about this, but he has to get these people out because otherwise the cartel that he works for is going to be extremely displeased with him, and that's not a good thing. So the story follows Luis and Nora in their attempts to get out of the United States into Mexico so her family can go on to their final destination. And it turns out that Nora has a secret, of course. And that comes out, of course. And not all is not as it seems. And so, you know, Luis gets balled up in that. In the meantime, he's got an Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent, McGinley, after him. And there's things going on, you know, political stuff going on at the top of the cartel that he works for, and his best friend, who is a mover in the cartel, is getting really squirrely about all of this. And so that's the bare bones of the story.
And that's a great bare bones, because it's one of these stories, at least in my reading of the book, where here's what I liked about the book, because there's a lot. So my list is long, which will have to be a different show of all the things that I liked about your book. But at the very beginning, you give a really quick synopsis of kind of the state of the world and what's going on. And I wasn't sure what that was when I was first reading that. But then as I got to page one of the book and started reading, I was like, oh, that totally set the stage. I always love a good sneak preview. And I think that's what you delivered at the beginning. And that I think that helps you as the reader going through the book to say, okay, now I've got to go to the next page, and you don't want to stop reading. And that right. To me, I can usually pick a book up, put it down. It's not a big deal, but South is one of these that I wanted to keep reading all day long. So
right.
Your style is fantastic. Where did you, I know you wrote stories as a child here, Lance, but did you take writing classes or do anything specific to hone your skill? Because this book, I was kind of surprised that you don't have another 30 books behind you.
Well, this was the seventh or eighth full-length work that I have written. It's only the second one that I've published.
Okay.
Doha 12 was the first. And so the ones before that, five or six before that, those were the learning ones that will never, appear anywhere.
Okay.
I never took any classes in creative writing. I learned it by doing it. In this latest incarnation, I've been with the Pure Fiction League critique group, which is, kind of the sponsor of Lit Up. And that's taught me a lot. You're reading other people's stuff and figuring out, why it's good, why it's bad, what do they need to change, that kind of thing. And then also having people do that to my stuff has really upped my game a lot. But there's nothing like sitting down and just putting, electrons to electronic paper to learn how to do it. I've read some books and stuff like that, but I didn't go to, I didn't get an MFA. I didn't go to school to learn how to do this. It's something that I've picked up over the years. So
what inspired the book? How did you say we're going to start this book in, several years in the future? I think that was also something that kind of surprised me, because I didn't expect a future book.
Right, although if you look at the future world in South, it doesn't feel very future, does it?
No, not really. But I think that was surprising too, because you're writing about these dates that are far off, but at the end of the day, it's not really that far off.
Yeah, and one of the reasons for that, I think, is that progress comes slowly to the poor, and most of the characters in this book are poor.
Mm-hmm.
And also 20 years is not really all that far. I mean, when you do the whole J.D. Robb's, death in, in death series, and they're like 100 years in the future, you can do anything. You can get away with anything on there. But if you're just doing 20 years, you really got to be pretty smart about it. So, there's basically nothing in South that doesn't already exist in one form or another. Could be in the lab, could be that kind of thing and so forth. But I'd just gotten done with Doha 12. I was looking for the next thing to do. And it's like, okay, what am I going to do now? And it was 2012, it was the election. You know, we'd had the crash in 2008, and you know, the Tea Party was going on. I was listening to these folks and thinking, you know, the kinds of things that they say that they want sound really familiar. And it turned out when I was looking, I paid them the compliment of taking them seriously and looking at what they wanted and figuring out how would that work. And it ended up, as far as I could tell, being, you know, kind of a pre-New Deal, pre-progressive era of America, kind of the second Gilded Age. Or it was China in 2005, which, you know, the same types of situations going on. So I was thinking, okay, well, what would that look like here? And so very quickly I got this set up for a world, and I said, okay, what do I do with that world? And I got this whole idea, well, you know, reverse migration and, you know, bringing back the Japanese Americans in the concentration camps and, you know, the surveillance and that, and ended up with Gilded Age, you know, 1890s America with the internet and drones. Or, like I said, China in 2005. And, you know, once I got that idea, the story just kind of put itself together. And I just, you know, sat down and started banging it out as fast as my little fingers could move. And it was really interesting. It was really hard to stay ahead of current events because I put something in and I thought, no, we won't have that for another 5 or 10 years. And like 6 weeks later, there'd be something
boom.
In the news. Oh, boom. Yeah, there it is. Like, hell.
So, how long of a process was it for you to write South? You know, from the time that you sat down until the time you actually had a copy of the book in your hand, what was involved?
Oh, boy. Well, I went through, let's see, I started writing it in 2012, or actually, you know, late 2011. And the last version I did in early, to actually mid-2013. And, you know, I wasn't really hurrying. Now, some part of that, I was unemployed. I'd gotten laid off from my job with Ericsson. And so I was, you know, either working part-time or, you know, I was doing volunteer work and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had time to do it, but I wasn't really hurrying. But that's what it took to get it written, get it mostly through PFL, and then decide to publish it. But... you know, I sat down, outlined it out. You know, I'm a big outliner. Those kind of books, you know, Doha 12 and South, there's so much going on and so many different people in so many different places doing different stuff that all has to sync up. There's no way you can shotgun it. You just got to write it all down and make all the connections ahead of time. So I did that and then just sat down and started writing.
And I think one of the things that I like about your book, South, is that all of the connections and all of the dots make sense when they are crossed and dotted.
Right.
You know, sometimes you'll read murder mysteries or intrigue or spy novels and you're like, I can't follow any of this. The writing's fine. The characters are great, but none of this makes sense.
Yeah.
And everything here just kind of blends together. And so as you're writing, you're a very visual writer. At least it was easy for me to kind of picture what these people look like in the
right.
shop and the garage and all of these, or the hospital, which is horrible.
Yeah.
And you're going, I can totally see this being a motion picture. Have you
yeah.
thought about what's going to happen next to the book? Is that something that you'd even be interested in doing?
Oh, sure. I mean, if somebody wanted to hand me a, you know, shovel full of money and say we'd really like to make South into a movie or a limited run television series, you know, premium cable, that
yes.
kind of thing, I say, yeah,
that
go
would...
for it. Please.
Yeah, it'd be like
please.
A great 8-episode or 13-episode season.
Yeah. Well, I actually did an 8-episode treatment for a limited-run series because there was a guy I knew from work who, you know, was also a screenwriter, and, you know, we were talking about it. Well, you know, how would this work? And so, you know, I put together, I guess, what the standard form is for a treatment for – or a pitch package. For a series, and then, you know, he kind of got busy with other stuff, and I don't really know anybody in the industry, and so I've got it sitting on my computer.
Well, we need
here,
to change that, Lance.
Interested.
We're gonna
yes,
figure
do.
Out how to get this made.
Okay. Yes, we do. But, you know, I figured out the casting, you know, the whole thing.
Oh.
So if anybody's interested, you know, let me know. I'm certainly persuadable on this. But I, you know, think some of the visual writing that you're noticing in there is me, you know, with like the film and TV design thing and doing the establishing shot, you know, the track shot, the medium close up, the insert, that kind of thing. Just through the way that I direct your attention to things. And so I was thinking of it. It was happening in my head as pictures, and I was transcribing the pictures.
Well, you do a great job, because I think that that is one area that a lot of writers struggle with, and you absolutely have got this mastered, because you paint the pictures so easily. And, you know, some books, they go on for pages about, you know, what a tulip looks like, or, you know, here's a picture of a rock for 17 pages. And you're like, why are you wasting my time? You get it done, you get us in, you get us out, and you get us moving. So the book moves quickly, and you find yourself halfway through the book, and you're a couple hours into your time. So I want to kind of shift gears, because I've got a couple of other things I want to ask Lance about. But everybody, we've got a link to Lance's Facebook author page, and also a link to his official website, which is called wombatgroup.com. So go and check that out. You'll find all the places you can buy the book. And not really switching gears, but switching gears, Lance, once you got the book done, what did you, I mean, did you have a marketing plan in place either before you sat down to write the book or formulate one mid-path, or did you wait till the end, and what did you do?
Well, actually, we need to kind of fall back to Doha 12. I had been querying that for a while and getting not much of a response. And, you know, like I said, I'd just been laid off. I had some time on my hands. I'd been kind of watching the whole indie publishing thing going on, and it was starting to become a thing. And I thought, well, you know, and nothing's going on the traditional way here, so, you know, why not give it a try? What's the worst that can happen? So I've self-published Doha 12, but before my wife would let me do that, she made me come up with a business plan. And
I
so
love
I
that.
Wrote this. Yeah, I know. And so I wrote this, you know, humongoid business plan on, you know, what it was that I was going to do and how I was going to try to market it and so on and so forth. And so that's what I had in place by the time I got done with South. And when I got done with South, I said, well, I'm not even going to bother to query this. I'm just going to put it out there and see what happens. And so I just took that plan and started, you know, trying to do that with South. And, of course, since I'd written the plan, some things had changed, and it was getting harder to, like, get reviews and stuff like that. And so I'm still kind of pushing against that and trying to figure out what to do. One of the biggest problems I run across with South is that it's really hard to describe in three lines. And you know, everybody thinks, oh, 2032, it's, you know, science fiction. No, it's not science fiction.
It's not.
Yeah, and, you know, it's a thriller, so I call it, you know, like a combination of, you know, The Handmaid's Tale and The Spy Who Came In from the Cold. And people kind of get that, but it's not a, you know, especially good description. But so that's what I did. And, you know, with the new one, with the collection, I've decided to query that some and see if I get any reactions. And then if I don't, then I'll have to sit down and figure out, okay, what am I going to do with this thing? And if I decide to self-publish it, I'll probably have to update the business plan, because a lot of things have changed since 2012 when I wrote that thing.
Well, as business plans go, I think that that's, you know, it's the ever-evolving plan that, you know, you think, okay, this is exactly how it's going to be, and whether I finish it tomorrow or next year, it's, you know, I'm going to live in a static world, and all things are going to work according to my plan, because nothing can change in a year.
Yeah,
and then,
exactly.
You know, you see
it does.
Exactly what happens. So from a touring, did you make plans to go out on tour, or are you doing any of the local book clubs, you know, bookstores, things like that?
I have done bookstores. I had an appearance at Book Carnival in Orange, which is an independent bookstore that specializes in mysteries and thrillers. And so that was good. I've spoken a couple of times at the Fullerton Library I've spoken, you know, here and there. And I've done Lit Up, like I said, for four times. And so yeah. I'm doing some of that. And, you know, the two of the things I was looking to do in the business plan, one was to sell libraries, and the other was to sell the book groups. And I found libraries are a really tough nut to crack for indie authors because their ecosystem is relatively closed to that. They want the traditionally published books, and regular book groups are hard to find, like physical book groups. There's a bunch of online ones, but if you're trying to find the physical ones where people get in somebody's living room and sit around and talk about it, those are really hard to locate unless you know people who are in them. And I don't know very many people who are in reading groups. So that's been really hard to do. I kind of beat my head against it and try to get in where I can. I'd say all the things, you know, I like the personal appearances and being able to talk best, because there I can make a connection with like actual real life people. And I think if they will listen for a few minutes, then they'll get interested in it, and you know, I get sales out of that, and then people go off and they tell other people about it. It's harder to do when I'm just, you know, trying to get somebody to go out and click on a website and go buy something.
Right. Yeah. Isn't that funny how, I mean, you can have the best product in the world, but if you don't have that connection with people, you know, forget it. It's just not going to happen. So
I know.
Now you have a few places that your book is available online. Where do you like people to go and buy your books directly?
Wherever. I mean, if you've got a Kindle, then go to Amazon. Don't have a whole lot of choice there. If you got a Nook, you can get it from Barnes & Noble. If you got a Kobo, you can buy it from Kobo and a number of their associate sites. So anywhere that you can buy Kobo books, you can buy it from there. If you want a hard copy, hard copies are available all over the world online. So wherever it is that you go to get it, it'll be the same copy. Just order it as, you know, what's good for you. So if you're in India, you know, order it off Flipkart. If you're in Germany, order it off of whichever German outlet I'm on. And if you're here, you can order it from Barnes & Noble. You can actually go into a Barnes & Noble store and order it, and they will send it to you, which is
pretty cool.
Yeah,
I love it.
Or get it from Amazon or whatever. So.
Well, you know, sometimes the artists, when they come on, they're like, if you buy it from this site, I actually make money. But if you buy it from that one, even though it's there, I'll see a dime. You know, so I always want to find out from, you know, the guest on where they prefer. So that's cool. So now you also, and I want to, we've got just a few minutes left. So you've got this YouTube channel up here called Crimes Against Art, and you're an avid diver and shipwreck maritime archaeologist. Okay, can we just add more to your plate? Where did this come from? And I'm...
Well,
this is why you have to come back, Lance.
Yeah, when I started writing again, which was back when I was in Intel Officer's School in San Angelo, Texas, and I started doing it to create some characters to keep me company, I started trying to write a series about a maritime archaeologist, and found out it's really hard to do science thrillers. They're both scientific and thrilling. But that got me back into it, and I had gotten interested in maritime archaeology and shipwrecks, and I'd been interested in shipwrecks ever since, you know, Sea Hunt and Jacques Cousteau and that kind of thing, watching them on TV. And, you know, I had learned to scuba dive when I was 40. That was my birthday present in Australia. And really liked that. I really enjoyed diving wrecks. And so that's how I got into that connection. Well, that kind of segued into art crimes. And I've been reading a lot about those. And the collection is the first in what I hope is a series centered around art crime. And in the process, I was doing all of this research, and I was finding all of these videos, and I really needed some place to put them or some place to organize them. And I thought, well, you know, YouTube, you can do this channel thing, and so I put together my own channel of art crime related videos, and now it's out there, and there's a few people who are following it, and so that's where that came from. And every once in a while I'll go out and I'll find a new one and I'll add it, but it's really useful for me because then it's organized and I can go find this thing.
Lord.
You know, I need that video about, you know, XYZ art theft or something,
mm-hmm.
and it can go and find it again, which is always a wonderful thing.
Very strategic. Now that does not surprise me at all with your explanation, Lance. So we got about a minute and a half, 2 minutes left. For other writers who are listening, new or old, not an age, but as far as experience goes, what advice would you give to people who are listening in tonight?
Read. Read a lot. Read critically. Especially read a lot in the genre that you're interested in doing, but don't get limited just to that. When you read the books, figure out what the author is doing and why and whether it works for you or not. And then write. And you can go to classes, you can read, you know, websites, you can do all that kind of thing, but the only thing that's going to teach you the real ropes on how to write for real is to sit down and do it and give yourself permission for the first couple of things you write to just really suck bad, but learn from it.
Yeah,
and every time you write something, get a little bit better. And, you know, find a critique group. Pure Fiction League has been great for me. It's taught me a lot of stuff. And get some people who will be honest enough to tell you that your baby is ugly when you give them this thing to read, because that's the only way you'll find out that what you're doing is working or not working. So read and write.
Read and write. Yeah. I think I fibbed to you. I said that was the last question, but now you've got me wondering, when do you write? Do you have a set schedule or a time block that you do every day? What is your commitment to yourself?
I write when I have time to. I mean, I've got a day job, and so I got to do that. And, you know, my wife and I go out and do stuff. I mean, go to the theater and things like that. So the rest of that time there is I'll do this and that, you know, when I can. And I don't really believe in writer's block. And you know, if I've got some time to write, I'm going to sit down and write, and it may just really blow, but I'm still getting words down on paper, and then I can edit it and make it better. But I take the time that I have available to me to do the writing, and I can write pretty fast when I'm in the groove.
Does it? And you say you don't believe in writer's block, but when you sit down and get into the groove, what does it take to get you there?
You know, it's hard to say, and a lot of it can be I've been thinking about the upcoming scene for, you know, X amount of time, and so I've got it worked out in my head, and now all I have to do is just sit down and actually write it, and you know, those can go pretty fast, or I've been having a problem with something, and I've, you know, moved past it to do something else, and then, you know, my mind will chunk along at it and then say, oh, this is what you need to do, and then I'll go back and fix that problem and then smooth it out and move on. So, you know, a lot of it is, I like to say that the first draft is in my head,
mm-hmm.
because that's how I figure out that there's actually something there. And so if I don't get bored with it, then there might be something to it. And then it's time to sit down and start writing. And that, I think, really helps me because I've already worked out a lot of the problems that I might run into as I go along.
There we go. Everybody, it's been Lance Charnas. His book is called South. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, everywhere fine books are sold. Go check out his website, which is wombatgroup.com. The link is on the show page. And Lance, it's been a pleasure having you on. I have to have you back to talk about Doha 12, and you know, we'll get that scheduled, but I'd love to have you back.
Okay.
So I appreciate you taking your time, and hello to your wife and your cat.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate you having me on board here, and I'd love to come back and talk some more.
Right on. Thanks, Lance. Have a great night. I appreciate you.
Okay.
Everybody else, I just want to give you a real quick reminder, no show tomorrow morning. Rebecca is going to have the day off. Instead of being up at 8 o'clock, she's going to let me go do a voiceover gig. So thank you, Rebecca, for that. Thursday on Rated LGBT Radio at 7 o'clock, Rob Watson and I welcome Daniela Sulek. She's the expert of law of attraction. And on the Friday night dance party, starting at a special early time of 6 p.m., 6 p.m. is hour one of the two-hour show, and that will be your request, because hour two, we're doing a world premiere of Ed Roman's new album called Red Omen, and we cannot wait for that. If you like the show, follow us on iTunes. You can get us as a podcast, or of course, just follow the show here and you get a text or email update every day that we are live. And that will take you to the unique individual episode for that particular day. It's a pleasure having you here with us tonight. Can't wait to see you again on Thursday night. So take care, everybody. Don't drive distracted. And you have been listening to
Rated G Radio.